Goddard Reel 8. Now, these flights which you were on would often be of quite a long duration. I think you said up to 8 hours. What kind of things would be going on in the airships during this period? How did you fill your time?
Well, I suppose it varied very much with individuals as to what their interests and zeals caused them to do with their time. When I said 8 hours, that was a fairly standard patrol, but the record for the SS type of airship was 27 hours. I think that was quite a long sit. 15 hours was not altogether unusual, but 8 hours was the sort of standard, and sometimes very much less. But I would take the kind of thing that I would do is test myself on my capabilities of navigation and my capabilities of estimating drift over the sea. You can imagine when you look at the sea, it's all very much the same unless there's some fixed point which changes its position relative to you when you're flying. Well, as often as not, the visibility was so low that you couldn't see anything in particular. I would estimate my drift by observing downwards. I didn't have any special apparatus except my bomb sight, which I've forgotten to mention before, and I would gauge my drift as best I could and gauge my forward speed and would lay off a course and would say that in 27 minutes' time, having done my calculation, I should be over the Vaan lightship. And I would then deliberately not look in that direction. I would be doing my lookout in other directions. I might give the observer instructions to look out on the starboard side, and I would look out on the port side, knowing that my drift was going to take me and my forward speed to approach the Vaan light so that it would come at us, so to speak, on the starboard bow. And in 27 minutes' time, I would test my navigation by looking downwards to see if the Vaan light was there. And on the first occasion, I was hopelessly disappointed to discover it was nowhere to be seen anywhere within a mile and a half or more of the visibility that I had got, until I peered right underneath the ship and found that the Vaan light was straight underneath me, pointing straight up at the bottom of my ship. That pleased me very much that my navigation was so accurate. I did the same thing another time. And the second time I did it was from a position where I didn't know where I was, but I had only guessed my position and I didn't know which course to steer. And I'd often heard it argued that the chances are 360 or 359 to 1 against your choosing the right degree to steer a course when you're lost and don't know where you are. And I argued, but rather perversely, that it was about even chances with something in your favor if you weren't frightened. And I said you could choose any course. And so I did and then test myself out twice in fairly dense fog to do this same exercise of approaching one of the lightships in our area from quite a long distance away. And again, on both those occasions, found the lightship bang under me. So I then knew that if one avoided being frightened, one would choose the right course, or would be, as it were, inwardly instructed to choose the right course. And this was a great refreshment to me. I didn't ever afterwards fear being lost completely at sea, and never was.
I noticed with interest that the airships were equipped to carry and use bombs, but in fact never did.
Oh,
For real.
yes.
What was the idea behind the carrying of dummy bombs?
Well, we had a bomb rack between standard for that type of aeroplane to carry either two 250-pound bombs or six, or was it eight? I think 100-pound bombs. Anyway, I've got my arithmetic wrong, but anyway, I know we could carry eight 100-pound bombs, I think it was. No, eight 20-pound bombs, that's what it was, 20-pound bombs. And those were carried initially, but by the time I had got to Capel, one or two of our own submarines had been accidentally bombed, not, I'm glad to say, by airship captains, but by flying boats who had been rather over-adventurous with their bombs and insufficiently informed. and had dropped them somewhere near our own submarines. This caused the Admiralty to decide that nothing in the air should be given such lethal weapons, and so we carried dummy bombs after that, so that anybody observing us or reporting us would say, well, that airship went away carrying a lot of bombs, and sometimes we'd come back not carrying those bombs, and nobody would know that we'd used them for ballast, and they would suppose that we had attacked some submarines or something of the sort. But in fact, all we did with those bombs was to practice using them in case at any time we should be given live bombs to carry. But we never were.
Yes. I believe that one of the problems you... well, it's probably a theoretical problem since you never had any direct contact with submarines, but one of the problems you had was that of visibility, actually seeing the submarines below the water.
Oh, yes.
And that in order to overcome this problem... Lord Cherwell, or Lindemann as he then was brought to Capel while you were there.
Yes.
to try some invention. Could you tell me about that episode?
Well, we were a bit discouraged because we said not only do we not see submarines, but perhaps even if they were visible, we couldn't see them because of the glare on the water. As you know, from looking out to sea in the sunward direction or in the direction of bright clouds, you can't see into the water at all because of the reflection from the surface of the water.
Yes.
And we reported this disability, and the Royal Aircraft Factory, as it was then called, at Farnborough, who had a bunch of boffins there, sent a young boffin down to Capel to investigate this because he had an idea of overcoming this glare by requiring us to use binoculars, which with polarized lenses, so that the horizontal reflections from the water would be cut out, and you'd only get a relatively minor reflection from the surface of the water. And that was perfectly true. And Lindemann flew with me. He was attached to me for about a fortnight or 3 weeks, and we flew on every possible occasion in all sorts of conditions of sunlight, and studied the effects, and he, to some extent, was able to measure the reduction of glare produced by the use of his binoculars. But as binoculars were things that we didn't like using, because in a slipstream it's rather difficult to use binoculars without getting a great deal of joggle, so that you couldn't actually get a steady image, this was, in a way, an interesting experiment, but rather a waste of time. I got to know him pretty well, of course, and quite enjoyed his vegetarian meals when I occasionally went out with him to a restaurant or somewhere or other to talk about the war or whatever.
What kind of impressions did he make on you? Can you remember any specific characteristics that struck you at this time?
Well, he was a theoretician, and that was quite clear. He was glad to be associated with practical chaps. He liked mess life. He was seemed to me then to be a bachelor who liked talking with young chaps. I found him really quite attractive and interesting, and he talked to me a good deal about aviation generally. But as I was not an aeroplane pilot, and he was already aspiring to be an aeroplane pilot, I don't think he was then, we didn't have much talk about that. We had a little bit of a talk about things which could be called philosophy, but I don't very much remember, except thinking, well, he was a pleasant and interesting man to talk to.
I believe that during this period at Capel, the word blimp to describe the SS ships was coined. Could you tell me how that came about?
Well, yes. First hangar to be built, as I have described, was built for a smaller type of airship than the ones that we actually built. And so it was necessary to dig a trench about 4 feet deep and about 6 foot wide, beginning 200 or 300 feet away from the mouth of the doors of the hangar, and extending right through the hangar at its maximum depth, right to the far end and out the other end. That meant that airships could be brought in at either end of the hangar, and it would hold two. So that when you were on the old floor of the hangar at the proper floor level and not in the deeper level, you could in fact put up your hand and touch the airship. And that meant that you could flip it. And as in fact my station commander, A.D. Cunningham, brother of quite a famous admiral and brother of quite a famous general, he was our station commander, and on Sunday mornings he would carry out the usual naval routine of inspecting the whole of his station, cookhouses and barracks and equipment and everything you had, and any airships that weren't on patrol had their crews with them at attention, smartly dressed, and he would see that they were properly cleaned and properly maintained, and ask questions of the captain. And he walked by my ship, and seeing that I'd got it properly up to pressure, he flipped the envelope as he could reach it, and it made a sound which he imitated by saying blimp. And I told this story in the mess at lunchtime, and thereafter my airship became called the Blimp. And that name became a generic term for all the SS types of airship, and has ever since been the name that's been applied to most airships. And there are two points that I'd like to make out of this, two points of exaggeration or misinformation. One was that being asked for an explanation of the word blimp, somebody who didn't know said it stood for a category of in a vocabulary which was an airship type B limp, which is, of course, a complete invention. And the other was Lowe, the cartoonist, who wished to portray somebody who looked particularly like a retired colonel who had laid down the law on many matters. And he called him Colonel Blimp and made him look like a kite balloon. And therefore the kite balloons also became called blimps, but that was for no particularly good reason, because they in fact were never kept up to pressure and wouldn't have made that noise if you flipped them.
One thing which interests me about this early period of airship flying is what kind of identity the airship pilots themselves had, particularly the way in which they saw themselves. For example, one has the romantic image of the dashing World War II Battle of Britain pilot. What kind of image did you have of yourselves?
Well, the image we had of ourselves was of midshipmen and sub-lieutenants who were naval officers, and I think we were proud to be members of the Navy. We were rather proud to have been selected for this task. We didn't really mix very well much with other people. We hadn't known until we mixed with the seaplane people a bit that we were slightly looked down on as people who were afraid to risk their necks by landing an aeroplane or a flying boat fairly fast. And we, in turn, had a slight disrespect for them in that they never liked to fly out of sight of land because they couldn't navigate. This was a mutual sense of superiority on both sides, and we felt rather superior to anybody who hadn't been trained to be a naval officer. We had two or three young airship pilots with us who'd been at schools and who had some sort of influence which enabled them to join in this airship party. There weren't very many of them, but we slightly looked down on anybody who wasn't entitled to wear the broad stripe and the curl.
Did you have any particularly interesting flights while you were at Capel?
Well, all flights to me were interesting, and all were different. I didn't really do anything frightfully adventurous, but I was credited with being a very brave man on one occasion. When I certainly wasn't brave, I was merely being curious. I was out on patrol on a Sunday morning, a bright summer's day, when, looking back at Dover, I saw puffs of white smoke in the air and realized that the guns were firing. And this seemed to me surprising, that they should be doing anti-aircraft practice or any sort of practice, shooting at a submarine or something, on a Sunday, unless there was something really to shoot at. So I turned round to see if they'd got a submarine in trouble there. And back I went to Dover. and came down very low and could see nothing, but the guns stopped firing, and I flew very low over the town and found that the whole population was out in the town and they were waving their hats. Many of them had been wearing straw hats, and they waved to me and seemed to be cheering from the ground as I sailed overhead. And everybody seemed to be out in the streets, and I wondered about this. I went back to Capel and landed to the landing party, and as I was landing, two big black limousines came careering across the airfield. This was a very unusual sight. And I got out of my... Well, I wasn't going to get out. I was going to be walked into the hangar when I saw that out of one car, close by, the commanding officer stepped, and he beckoned to me. So I clambered out of my airship, and everybody stood where they were. And then another big man got out, and he was wearing a large chain round his neck, and that was the mayor of Dover. He'd come from some civic function, I supposed, and he was accompanied by another carload of people also in rather formal dress with long tailcoats. Not tailcoats, I forget now what they were called, but the sort of morning dress that people wore for formal occasions. And they greeted me and wanted to be introduced to this gallant pilot who had driven away an air attack on Dover, which had disturbed their annual civic church service. And so I said how to do it to them, and I'm afraid rather spoilt the whole thing by denying all knowledge that Dover had been attacked by air. But they were firmly convinced that I and my airship had driven away this pilot who had been dropping bombs on Dover. And of course, that was the first.